Hello, everyone, comrades and friends. Little show update before we start. We've kind of mentioned over the course of a few months, I've been having issues with my eyes. I've had a bunch of stuff going on my whole life. I won't bore you with it. But I had a surgery in April, and my vision has been very poor for a few months, to the point where it's been tough to read anything or sort of work on the computer. Good news is my surgery was this week, my second one. So I should be all tip-top in another week or two. What we did is record an episode about a week and a half ago that we're going to play for you now. I talked to two young guys from Delaware who went to the protests in D.C. When Netanyahu came to speak in D.C., when they did the rally, the Nazi rally in the Senate chamber, which is odd. It's an odd place for it. That's all I'm saying. But yeah, I just wanted to talk to these guys and find out like what their experience is like and sort of what drew them to it. I'd never met them before. They were sort of introduced to me sort of through the loose network of people who are working with the pro-Palestinian activists here. But yeah, it was really enlightening conversation. They'll introduce themselves, so I won't do it now. Enjoy it. I noticed a lot of you really enjoyed our last episode with Eric Razorsham. I know what to give you if, you know, it's like, I feel like a heroin dealer. Like, I want to give you the good stuff, but you just like the most gossipy stuff. I'm trying to help y'all, but this is what we're doing. All right, left is best. So, we were on a chat, big sort of group chat, and somebody sent the Dave Matthews clip from D.C., the Dave Matthews band, Dave Matthews, of the, I guess they're college rock from the 90s, whatever you call it. And he was there, you know, protesting like everybody else for basically the same reasons. And it was thrown in the chat, and Medina Wilson Anton, actually, a representative from Bear, put in the chat. It was Jess. Jess said, oh, it's the coolest white South African of all time. And Medina was like, oh, I didn't know he was from South Africa. I was like, yeah, he's from Joburg. But I sent her a link to this guy, Ronnie Casserolls. Ronnie Casserolls grew up in a Jewish suburb of Johannesburg. His grandparents had fled Latvia, I think. He was about 19 when in South Africa they had the Sharpsville massacre, where the cops came out and just opened fire on a large group of people. And that radicalized him. And he joined the ANC. And he was asked in the 60s to go to London to recruit white college students, like good-looking college students, to come back and do, like, espionage because they could get into the country because now there was a crackdown. I think the ANC was working from Zimbabwe at this time. Could have been Tanzania. But Oliver Tambo asked Ronnie Casserolls to go. He was going to the London School of Economics, and he recruited white college kids who were resistors, mostly resistant to Vietnam War in I guess this was the late 60s. One of the people he recruited was a guy from New York, Danny Schechner, who became like a TV producer, like a news producer. He produced documentary films. He was from a Jewish neighborhood in the Bronx. He grew up in a co-op, in a co-op building that was owned by the Garment Workers Union. But he was recruited at the London School of Economics, and he went to South Africa, I think in 70 or 71, with a suitcase with a false bottom. Sometimes they would bring in, you know, explosive devices. Sometimes they would bring in devices that would explode but just shoot out pamphlets, like propaganda papers from the ANC, you know, on the street somewhere. They would time them, and then they would go off. Really, really interesting stuff. There's a book about it called London Recruits. And I think they made a movie of it, but I'm not sure if it's out yet. But the thing about Ronnie Casserolls is he wound up being a guerrilla commander and a Marxist revolutionary. And he was the first defense minister and minister of veterans affairs in a apartheid-free South Africa under Mandela. He was an intelligence commissioner or an intelligence deputy under Thabo Mbeki. And he's still alive, and he lives outside Johannesburg today. So everybody's in on it, and there's a few good white South Africans. Comrades and friends, hello. We're in the shadow of Rockford Tower. We're behind enemy lines. We're in the belly of the Delaware Way beast. And I brought some friends in to talk about their experience, why they're doing what they're doing, and also how you can potentially join them. I think it's important. Guys, you want to introduce yourself, Henry? Do you want to?
Yeah, my name's Henry. I'm pretty new to all this. I've never done a podcast before, but I'm here to tell my story if you guys want to hear.
I definitely want to hear. Hold that thought 1 second.
Hi, so I'm James, and I've been aware of the situation going on in Palestine, West Bank, you know, occupied Palestinian territories for... 25, so about 11 years. Never really felt like I had an ability to do anything about it. That kind of changed around 2021 during the Israeli aggression around that time. But I was in college, and I still just didn't really feel like, you know, I had the time or the liberty. You know, I was just focusing kind of on me. And then, yeah, after October 7th, I knew things were going to be different. And I think it really hit me, especially, deeply is not the right word, but, I had a really bad feeling when I heard the news. A day later, I was, touring Anne Frank House, in Amsterdam. Everybody knows who Anne Frank is, and it's the tragedy of her family and all that. And I saw all of the parallels, right? Like it was fresh on the news.
I've been in Anne Frank House too. It's funny because the Anne Frank House, actually, I didn't go the first time I was in Amsterdam because I didn't think I could handle it. And then when I went back and I actually went to the Anne Frank House, I was right. It's pretty heavy.
And you got to book your tickets like a month out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See, when we did it, we had to line up. They had like two showings, and you just had to line up for one. But it did go down the street there. Yeah, it's cool. I it was just because I knew what I was getting as a souvenir. I got a copy of the diary in Dutch. I still have it downstairs. Henry, are you from here or? You live here now?
Yeah, I live in Delaware now. I'm originally from Reading, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
So I moved down here in 2019, end of 2019, right before COVID.
Oh, nice. So perfect timing.
Yeah.
How did this this issue kind of come to you?
As funny as it sounds, my leftist journey started with Hasanabi on Twitch.
Okay.
It's a contentious person, but it got me there at least. I think like I grew up in a very poor but white household. Never knew my biological parents, grew up with my grandparents, and I was in a very diverse area. And so I've always had kind of more like leftist leanings, but never understood what that meant. Never understood, like, that other people have had these feelings before, too. And then after I moved to Delaware and COVID happened, and then, the political fiasco since 2016 mainly, but in 2020, I started looking into politics more, because I was always like I don't want to talk about politics. It's kind of too much for me. And then I found Hasanabi on Twitch, and he kind of introduced me to leftist theory.
Yeah. Look at that, Hasan. Hasan Piker, the crazy Turk. Yeah, that. See, obviously, I'm an older guy, and I because I started this, I do have like a few real heavy influences, like on the internet streamers, and well, mostly like YouTube shows. But yeah, I know who that guy is. I really like him. I like his sort of approach to things more than anything. Like, I know it's like a Twitch streamer is like a hot guy and all that stuff. Yeah, I love the way, because I couldn't do it. Like, I'm doing something, I'm trying to be, like, entertaining on the microphone for leftists in the area, so I guess we're kind of doing the same thing, but I could never do that. Like, I don't have that skill or that outreach. I'm not a gamer either, so that doesn't help. But that's pretty cool. Like, so you just got drawn in because you thought it was a cool thing, and then as he started explaining sort of political stuff, you're like, okay, it kind of fell together for you.
Yeah, I've always had like I've always questioned why are there poor people? What makes them poor? How comes this person seems to work harder than another but makes less money? And then after listening to him, and reading the theory,
there you go.
It clicked. I was like, oh, people have already thought this stuff. People have already worked through this. So it kind of like affirmed these opinions I've had, and that felt awesome, because I always felt like an outsider. Like, why are there people getting bombed? I grew up with unregulated internet access. I saw the
breach.
Yeah, I saw the drone strikes in Syria, and I was like, that could have been my cousin. I could have been born in Syria. You know what I mean? Like. So
how old were you for that?
I'm 28 now.
No, so like witnessing.
I was really young, way too young to be looking at that stuff on the internet. But it like affirmed these feelings I've had for a long time. And I do agree that like the way Hasan goes about it, where he tries to make it more relatable, like me as a shaved head white guy, like a lot of people. I'm around on a daily basis are older white guys that will actually listen to my opinion because of my appearance. And I think Hasan has done a good job at using his appearance to make stuff like this more appealing.
Yeah, I catch myself as another. I have one up on you because I'm an older white guy. So people think they listen to shit I say all the time. They can't help it. They see me. They're like, it sounds, it's crazy, but I have to listen to it. You know, so joking aside, though, I am, you know, I'm in organizing situations sometimes where and all of my comrades and friends have pointed it out. We've talked about it sort of behind the scenes. All the black guys and the black women I organize with know that there are certain people that listen to me that don't listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't even know they're doing it. You know, they don't even sort of realize that they're just subtly more dismissive of them than they are of me. And I mean, it's easy to pick up on when you're the person, like where you can see like, well, why are you, how's this mm-hmm. working? But yeah, there's really something to that. So I'm trying to leverage that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like a Ronnie Casseroles. Going back to that. You know, but that's a true I got to look it up because I know they were making a movie of it and I'm fascinated. And I obviously I know the story, but I've never seen like a real good like a version of it of just like we need radical good-looking white kids to go smuggle shit into South Africa, you know? They did. That's what they did. So are you, your politics was sort of this, you came out sort of similar politics, but you came to it not later, but right after school, really.
Well, that was specifically regarding, you know, Palestine. Okay. and the occupation. my, you know, what started off as liberal and then gradually shifted leftist, you know, kind of origins. Honestly, I was just reflecting so much at hearing you talk about yours and just your kind of innate, I guess, at least the way it came across to me, your innate, you know, like critical thinking and that self-awareness of like, well, you know, why are they working, you know, equally as hard and having different outcomes? And I didn't have that experience. I think I kind of had a very, you know, I don't want to say biased, but my family was just very like diehard Democrat, like just everything that Democrats, they're like institutionally Democrat. I grew up pretty poor, you know, my parents weren't together. And my mom honestly was pretty much influenced by whatever, like the guy that she was seeing at the time, like his views. And then I really just, I witnessed what you were kind of saying so firsthand, mm-hmm. with some of the, you know, like her boyfriends, right? She was, you know, people like to, you know, harass me in high school that I had an attractive mom, and well, she had fairly well off boyfriends. And I saw how much they worked, and I saw how they got to where they were, and the opportunities, how they kind of snowball in that situation. And I realized it had nothing to do with how hard you worked, right? It was so much the lottery of birth. Mm-hmm. And I just, yeah, the amount of times I saw, you know, millionaire after millionaire just worked half as hard as every single kid I saw at McDonald's. And that radicalized me really quick. And then I was also like, as soon as I left those spheres, right? Like, we're going on a trip to Florida. We're going to the Florida Keys on their boat. And he's having his dog chauffeur down to Florida so he can drive his boat down to Florida. And then as soon as I'm removed from that space, you know, I'm back, like, sharing a bedroom with my mom until I'm 14. And she's busting her ass. And my dad's busting his ass. My grandparents are busting their ass. But, like, it wasn't about hard work.
No. I mean, that resonates with me too, because I came up in it. I'm a product of it. You know, I'm a sort of weird, because right out of University of Delaware, I went and started working at a bank, and it sucked. It was like terrible hours, answering the phone. I felt like I was really going to work. Didn't pay that great, you know. But I was in a position where it did sort of snowball. And it seemed like it wasn't through hard work, though. It was through, like, gaming the system, you know, making sure that however you were going to be judged, you made sure that looked good. And you worked your way up through, like, a corporate thing like that. And you get to a point where you're like, didn't make any sense. I didn't do anything special, you know. Why did this come down to me? Seems more like luck. And it doesn't have to be this way. You know, we don't have to put up with this. And it goes for everything, really.
Mm-hmm.
So I will say this. I was struggling to figure out how to ask this question only because it's like, it's sort of like the crux of what I do. So there's no real answer, but to go from sort of understanding that there are like systemic economic, really, limitations because of the system that we run, and then what that means for how we police here, how we police other places. To go from understanding that to, like, deciding that you're going to put your body on the line for it, or put your reputation on the line for it, or whatever, that's actually a huge step. It's like the step from realization to action, which you guys have made pretty a lot younger than I did. So I wonder, what did you always know if there was an opportunity you were going to do something where you were going to take action on this?
So after my what I'll call leftist journey, I realized like how much other people have assisted me in getting to the point where I have the ability to join an action. Like, I'm at the point where I can afford to drive down to DC and attend this action when some people can't. And then when October 7th happened, at that point, I knew very, very little about Palestine or even, like, how Israel was created. Like, I knew very, very little. But it gave me a reason to research it, to learn about it. And then just seeing how like, indefensible what's happening over there is radicalized me to the point where I, as a person that can afford to go do something about it, I like, feel like I couldn't just sit around. I have to go do something because I'm in that situation to do something. So.
Yeah, it's like a compulsion.
Mm-hmm.
I know exactly what you mean.
Well, the only thing for evil to prevail is good men to do nothing, right?
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing, too, is that this particular issue highlights it, and your whole sort of journey is like this. It's like, oh, they're not telling us, like, people have actually, you know, the information is there.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of see how it plays itself out, but nobody, you know, I know before... Carl and I would have conversations before October 7th. I mean, we've been doing this 5 years, 6 years, something like that, way back. I mean, when we opened this, after 15 episodes, we opened this studio, and that flag went up, I think, the next week. Because I'm a little bit older, and I followed, like, the South African thing. I mean, you can imagine what Ronnie Caserol's opinion about the Palestine-Israeli conflict is, obviously. Same as Mandela's. But it was... The information had to start sort of coming out. It wasn't easily accessible. Like, nobody's sitting around talking about Rashid Khalidi or like Ilan Pape or something. Like, the historians and the people who sort of can tell you how this all transpired. But now that those people are coming more to the fore and people are reading, like, Edward Said and stuff, they're coming to it because it's pretty clear, you know, what it is. It hasn't always been this way. It doesn't have to be this way, but you know, colonial massacres are something that have happened. We know why they happen, and we got to try to stop it. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
So how long were you in D.C.?
I was just there Wednesday.
Just the Wednesday.
Yeah, I could only take one day off.
I got you. How about you?
I was there for 2 days. I went down on Tuesday morning to participate in a JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace. The action that they did at the Capitol.
Yeah, that was incredible. That got a lot of they got a lot of coverage, obviously.
Amazing organizers. Just shout out and thank you to every single one that made it possible to pull it off and get our message out there.
Yeah. Did you stay with them overnight and go back out the next day?
Yep.
Yeah.
And it was a late night. I was very blessed to be let out, or, you know, regain my freedom at 2:30-ish. There were folks who were not getting, you know, out until 5:30 or 6. And I saw them there on Wednesday, marching, playing their instruments, you know, showing up for Palestine.
Yeah. They take you to that that garage holding, or they take you to the one in the park?
Yeah, so you're familiar with the garage?
Yeah, I've been in the garage.
You've been, okay. I didn't know they were, like... I didn't know it was that well known.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll get, like, tattooed, like, tallied for...
No, I just, I remember, it was actually, I remember it because it was the first day I met Bernie. I met him a couple times since then, but right at the beginning of the Trump administration, right before they passed all the corporate, rich tax cuts, when they were trying to get him not to do that. And so we did a big thing outside of a Senate conference room. And a bunch of people went inside the conference room, and then we blocked the door of the conference room. And yeah, it was pretty wild. But yeah, I guess I got arrested with about 30 or 40 people, not quite as many as got arrested when you just went down. But yeah, they took us all to that garage sort of setting and processed us all one by one through there. Wasn't too bad. Like, again, same thing. I was like, the organizers sort of know how to get you, how to, you know, give you the money, tell you what's probably going to happen. You don't really know. But, you know, there's a process, and people are there for you, which is hugely helpful.
Which is what woke me up again to the incredible like injustices in our system. Like when you don't have that support system.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. Can you imagine what it's like for anybody that doesn't know what to expect, that doesn't have the money they need, and they're just let out on the street with nobody there?
Yeah. Yeah, it's scary. I mean, it's scary too because, and they probably told you this or some facet of this, depending on how many people you're with. But yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot of actions in D.C. The Capitol Police arrest people on a regular basis, not that many, but, you know, fairly regularly. So you kind of know what to expect. However, if you do something like, if you go into the House chamber or Senate chamber, you might not get out, like, as easily as paying your $50 to get out. If you're like a habitual person, sometimes they make you sign something that says you won't come back to D.C. and protest for 6 months. So there's different ways to get snagged up. So, like, that's what everybody gets told. Like, it could be, this could go the easy way, and it probably will, or it could go the hard way. But the good thing about having organizers is they also have, you know, law support. You know, it's not going to be pleasant sitting in a jail cell for a day or two, but you can rest assured people are behind you when you go down in numbers like that with organizers like that.
Exactly. And you're always planning, and you're not planning, you're always hoping and anticipating, and the goal is to, you know, get your message out and leave. Like, nobody goes there with any intent to go to the garage.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's if you sit down or if you don't disperse, like, we don't want to hear this anymore, well, you're going to stay. And that's how the message is getting out. Yeah, I remember I was having my zip ties on, and I was sitting next to the woman. I don't know how we got next to each other. Was the woman who was with me blocking the door as they were trying to take people out. So I guess we just got jammed up together. And she just looked at me and she said, you know, you're a very good yeller. She's like, it's very loud. I'm like, you know what? Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. She was like, it's incredible. Incredible chanting. Nice job. I was like, so nice. It's just like, I don't know how it was with you guys. There's this incredible spirit when you do stuff with a lot of people too.
For sure.
Absolutely.
For sure. It was like, I'm very new to, like, in-person organizing. I've only been attending a protest for maybe a couple months. The level of support that's in these groups, the level of organizing and thought that goes behind this it's very, very hopeful. Like, prior to attending any events, it is very doom and gloom out there if you don't have any kind of support network. And
by design.
Yeah, for sure. Whether it's JVP or I think PSL did a lot of organizing down in DC, it was amazing to see, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, if you, and this goes back to what you were saying about, like, Hassan, it's like, yeah, if you're sitting at home sort of getting mad and you don't really understand what the situation is, and you feel sort of isolated and atomized, yeah, I mean, you're not going to be, you're kind of stuck. But he's able to sort of speak to tons of different people, say, actually, you can get together. There's something else going on here. It's very motivating.
Mm-hmm.
That's very cool. So you, James, were in the Capitol for the first day.
Yep.
When you went down, Henry, what did you get yourself into?
I wake up very early most days, and I wasn't planning to stay the whole day originally. So to help the local group of Delaware protesters, I was going to go down and just assess the situation early on Wednesday and try to find a place for the bus to park. So I arrived probably at 8:30.
You're doing recon.
Yeah. Recon.
Like, yeah, yeah. We gotta look, folks, we gotta fucking recon, man. So this is serious business.
Yeah. And I you know, it was kinda cool seeing it getting set up, but it was helpful. Unfortunately, like, my bus drop off point didn't work for them because they had half the city shut down. But it was good to get a lay of the land, see where the police had places barricaded, and I was able to buy a shirt while I was down there too.
Nice.
Early, so
Yeah, the bus move is correct. I try to, if I can, I take the train, if I can, because then I know I can, like.
People sleep on it, but it's nice. Wilmington to Union Station, it's a nice route.
It's not bad, and you can kind of like, if stuff goes down, you need to dip. You just dip, get on the train, the hell out of there. So, but I've done the bus. I think the last time there was one time that was so I don't remember what we were doing down there, but we parked at like where the old RFK Stadium is and had to walk all the way to Capitol Hill. It took like an hour and a half. It's a pain in the balls. But you met up once the bus got there. You were able to meet up with the group once they got down.
I think the main event was on the west side of the Capitol building at like the main facing side. They had to park on the opposite side, so the east side of the Capitol building, and the police had the entirety of the Senate Park blocked off. So instead of being a 15-minute walk from end to end of the Capitol building, it ended up being like 40 minutes, 45 minutes.
So you got out on day two and went back out.
Yeah.
So you got arrested in the Capitol day one, stayed, and went back out on day two.
Yep. I hopped in my ride and... don't remember if I even got the name of the ally who was driving us home, but shout out, thank you so much. Drove me to my Airbnb, fumbled around with the code for 5 minutes, thought I was locked out, got myself in, took a shower, woke up 5 hours later and got back on the road, yeah.
What'd you get into the second day?
We were keeping it low key.
Yeah.
We were all pretty tired. One of the amazing things about, you know, having a group, whatever the group is, and even if that group is you and a single friend, is just having that buddy. And what I think a lot of groups should strive for is having an easy way to identify yourself, right? It was so comforting when you're running off of 4 hours, 5 hours of sleep, and right, I probably have a collective 8 hours of sleep over 2 days because I woke up early to take the bus down on Tuesday. And just knowing, like, if I recognize a shirt, that, like, those are my people, was an incredible weight off my shoulders. Because, I mean, people were getting pepper sprayed. There were flashbangs going off. I had never experienced a flashbang before. I don't know if you have, Henry.
No.
I thought it was a gun.
I did too.
I legitimately thought, oh my God, we're being shot at.
Mm-hmm.
But just having, like, instant recognition of where my people are was very reassuring and brought a lot of peace. But yeah, we marched from where the speakers were speaking. I honestly was so tired. I have no geographical sense of where I was. But we started where they were speaking, and then we wrapped around all the way to Union Station, and then we hung out at Union Station for a little bit. We saw them take down the American flag, replace it with the Palestinian flag. Lots of drama ensued.
Yeah. You made a viral moment.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, very nice. So now we get into the next part of the program is like sort of what's next. I said this early on. You know, we all have to sort of steel ourselves for, you know, a very long process. It's a sort of the beginning of it. I feel like it's an awakening. I kind of remember this when I was younger, because the guy I mentioned at the beginning, Danny Schechner, was one of the people who I think he contacted Steve Van Sant, the guy who was on The Sopranos and the E Street Band, and they put together a big album in the 80s that they weren't going to play Sun City, which was a big resort in South Africa, and it was like a boycott. So it was part of the artist boycott and the economic boycott of South Africa during apartheid. And, like, that stuff's just starting to gain traction now. You know, obviously the BDS and the other sort of just acute political actions are going to need to get really ramped up at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're in a real bad, bad situation. And you guys probably felt that viscerally just being down there. Of a, you know, real bad one. I forget my question now. yeah, I guess when are we going out next, really? How did you got?
Can I speak to something you said real quick?
Yeah, absolutely can.
So, you know, you mentioned this feeling like an awakening. And, you know, I was also at the November, you know, March in D.C. and the January March in D.C. as well. Very different, you know, protests in terms of the density. I think the volume and the total number of people were actually pretty similar, you know, for this recent action on Wednesday. But the energy was different. This recent Wednesday versus those past two massive marches on DC. And what I mean by that is not just, you know, and the other two were almost more of a production. The stage was bigger, you know, in November and January. It was so dense, the way they had designed that event, those two events, to really funnel everyone into one big space and to feel those numbers. It took you 20 minutes to, you know, to get from the center of the crowd to the outside. So it really sucks when a bird sits on your head.
It's good luck.
Yeah, that's what the girl behind me said.
See?
Yeah, she was picking bird shit out of my hair.
Yeah,
so I don't know
like,
how I feel about that.
So it's a person who doesn't get shit on and be like, it's fine.
But the energy there felt like these are all of our people who have been here. And there are a few new people, right? Like it felt like maybe like 90%, you know, allies who have been in this space fighting for a free Palestine, fighting to end, you know, American imperialism for way longer than I've been. But this recent action felt like a lot more people like Henry were out there. I took a couple videos actually of like, I kept him like, you know, when the white girls are out here for Palestine, like, you know, things are changing. Like your basic white girl out here for Palestine. And you just, the families, right? It was, you know, children, parents with their, the white, you know, stereotypical American family pushing their strollers. Just the demographics were completely different. The energy was different. The hope was in the air, which is ironic, right? Because we have, you know, the head of this genocide, you know, here receiving a round of applause from our representatives. But the atmosphere in the streets was things are changing.
Yeah, like trained seals they were.
Mm-hmm. I agree fully. Like, I mean, like I said, it gave me a reason to get up and out. Like, I was kind of probably ripe for radicalization prior to this, but it gave me a reason. It gave, like, people I know that were very, like, libertarian, kind of like, more right-leaning libertarian, even they have a hard time like agreeing with what Israel is doing. But I think that, and I don't know about the January or November protest, but I'm assuming they didn't bring any of the New York police officers down for those, right?
No.
Yeah. I think that both America and Israel feel how much support is happening. And that's why I think it was like 300 New York police officers came down to be like bike police officers in D.C.
Yeah, I saw the morning of, very early, one of the videos I saw was somebody on the street. Could have been from you. Who knows? someone on the street taking a video sort of down the block, and it was just like NYPD vans, like passenger vans, coming down, you know, four or five of them coming out of the block. And I was just like, okay, here we go.
I mean, look at that. It looks like a police state.
Yeah.
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 It was crazy to see, like, I've only been in D.C. a couple of times until that point. But to see that many New York police officers, their buses, their bikes, like, in the middle of D.C. just because some people are marching was crazy. It was crazy.
When you wonder where were they on January 6th? Everybody knew what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. Like, that wasn't private information, that there was going to be a massive protest at the Capitol on January 6th. But where were all those NYPD officers?
They were. I mean, they were there.
Yeah,
they were not. They weren't uniformed. Yeah, I was, and anytime there's a mix of, and we saw this during sort of the George Floyd protests in D.C. too, where you saw, like, all kitted out, like RoboCop type of thing, with no like no markings. You couldn't tell whether they were from like, yeah, there you go. Yeah, you can't even fucking tell where they're from. Like it's weird stuff. Yeah, when we wonder why we get policed the way we get policed, it's all sort of the same, sort of the same concept.
Yeah, and I think kind of like hindsight looking back, a lot of people the day after, after me being there, like I saw the Black Lives Matter protests and whatnot, and how they got labeled after the fact, and how they were like, this is extreme violence, and you know, the action that happened down in DC was fairly tame, in my opinion, being there as never gone to something so large before. But like when we first started marching, we got maybe a block away from where the stage was, and they had this is where the barricade started to block off the Senate Park, and I think the march stopped and demanded us like let us walk next to the Capitol building, and of course the police didn't let us do that, but like everything was pretty peaceful at this point. And there's a video, I don't have it pulled up, but one of the police officers from like behind the line of other police officers just started like spraying pepper spray over the crowd.
I saw that video. I thought that was one of the weirdest things I ever saw, because you're like going over people's heads, like pepper spray doesn't stay where it's. Mm-hmm. It was ridiculous. I think if I remember, like another cop kind of like pulled that guy back and was like, "What are you doing, dummy?"
Because like not only did you just pepper spray your friends, the other police officers, but like we weren't doing anything. There might have been like people like yelling at the police officers as you do at these things, but there was no violence, and it caught me off guard because our group was pretty close to the front at this point. And I was like, we're just marching. This is fun. Like, but then when you hear the people yell, and you know, this is the first time I've ever gotten like pepper spray in my eyes. It was very eye-opening that they escalated
one or the other.
Yeah, that fast.
Yeah, I think that's I haven't been in too many tricky situations, but a couple. And that's the thing, is they escalate. Usually the cops will escalate it, because similar to like even incidents, like we had an incident in Bear where the cop pulled the lady out of her car. Again, they're going to escalate only because they feel like you're not doing everything they're telling you to do. Mm-hmm. Just don't yell at me. Don't push on the thing. Go over there. You can't come this way. And if they don't like the cut of your jib, you know, they'll press forward. They'll try to kettle certain people. They'll pepper spray, all that stuff. But it happens real fast.
And that's exactly what happened at JVP's, you know, protest. They're really just chanting outside of the DNC. What was that, back in either, I can't remember what month it was. It's all kind of a blur. I want to say it was last year or early this year. But it was extremely peaceful. Just, you know, protesting outside of the DNC, like headquarters in D.C. And I think it was around the time that Hakeem Jeffries and Schumer were sharing a stage with John Hagee. I'm assuming a lot of people know who John Hagee is. If you don't, look him up. He said some pretty terrible things. He's a
big Christian preacher guy. Mm-hmm. Well, Christian, I'll do this. That's my famous, like, you can't hear it on the radio, but yeah it's, you know, he's kind of a nasty little guy.
And yeah, they were protesting the fact that you know, leaders of the Democratic Party are going to be sharing a stage with this man who is extremely anti-Semitic, right? And the police, for no reason other than, like, what you're saying, they didn't like the fact that people were outside this building. It made them feel unsafe. So the politicians in the building, you know, they start tweeting that there's a violent mob outside.
Oh, I remember this now.
The police were literally, bike cops were taking their bikes and shoving, you know, women, older women down a bunch of stairs and pepper spraying each other. And I'm pretty sure it all kicked off from one cop pepper spraying into the crowd, just how you described, in the moment, getting a bunch of other cops with their pepper spray stream. And then instantly news outlets were running with the police statement, officer was pepper sprayed, and then violence ensued. Yeah, pepper sprayed by who? A fellow officer.
Well, as someone who, like my day job is, I work on police reform, policy, and organizing. And it's very, very interesting to see how all this stuff is put in the media. You know, it's like a gun went off. Pepper spray was dispensed. Like, did it do it by itself? Did anybody? Like, there was just a thing in Dover where they rolled up on a guy on a tip, you know? He had, like, weed and a loaded gun or something. I think he tried to get away. He was, like, sleeping in his car. And, you know, they try to apprehend him, and a rifle goes off. Oh, it just goes off? Like, you know, are we ever going to be able to figure out why? Probably not. But, yeah, it's just, like, that's the story can never be active. Like, who did what to whom when? Mm-hmm. It has to be like, this stuff sort of happened, and really it was agitated by, you know, people who shouldn't have been there. Because the cops can never do anything wrong.
Well, we see that parallel so much with the IDF.
I was just about to say that.
Yeah. I was wondering whether we were going to get into that because of all the trained to cross-training. I mean, you might as well say, because I think you know, but there's so much sort of, you know, cross-training and partnerships, you know, reaching across the Mediterranean, you know.
Yeah, just the one that comes to mind, like, recently, maybe a week or two ago, they found the bodies of two hostages in Gaza. And the way the IDF reported it was, oh, yeah, the dead hostages were found under, I think it was, like, Khan Yunus or something. But they never announced how they died. How did they die? Like, you think that they wouldn't, if it was Hamas that, like, shot them or starved them to death or whatever they want to say it was, you think that they wouldn't announce that instantly? Like, it's kind of the same thing. I mean, the IDF does train the police officers, like.
Yeah, and it's such a, I guess I'm going to do another history thing since it just tipped me off. I wish I could remember the name of the British officer. But it sort of goes to sort of the idea that Israel's always been like a colonial project. So during the mandate, the British mandate in the late 30s, there was an Arab uprising just before Israel. And there was a British officer whose name I cannot remember, but he had a really British name. Like, I think it was Winchester or Montgomery or something like that. Actually, I do think it was Winchester, now that I think of it. Anyway, he was in charge of, like, training the Haganah and the Zionist terrorists on, like, how to take a village, how to repel sort of this Arab uprising and then go take villages later on. So it was all sort of a process that happened starting in the mandate times with the military and the cops showing Zionists how to defend their stuff, how to keep the Arabs in check. And so when there was a handoff, they were ready. It's the same, you know, it's all police state shit, really.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what my grandmother said as soon as I was sending her pictures from Wednesday. And her and my grandfather were both, you know, 20 plus year Army vets. Like, she was in Desert Storm, you know, Kuwait, you know, she was dedicated her life to serving our country. And she breaks down in tears probably daily at this point, you know, fully aware, you know, mostly aware of what we're doing and what we stand for now. And just seeing those pictures really shook her. She goes, you know, she said to me, like, that looks like a police state. And I said, well, that's the police state, you know, under the lesser of two evils. That's what happens when we keep voting that way.
Mm-hmm. You want to get into it? You want to get into a little politics and do a little politicky? Okay.
I'm here to talk.
You ready? So, It's interesting that you say that. So I don't usually get into this kind of stuff, but since you guys are here, maybe this is a good one. So now that Biden has decided not to run again, or it was decided for him, or he might not even know. Really, the thing that made me most upset, not that I would vote for Biden anyway, I probably wouldn't because it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter, folks. Do whatever you want. Especially in Delaware, it doesn't matter. Yeah. But I was like, okay, well, you know, I'll hear Kamala out. You know, okay. You know, especially if she sort of like publicly gestures towards something different. Well, you know, I don't know why. And again, I'm not naive. I wasn't expecting this. I'm not like, she's going to pivot and we're going to get everything. Like, I don't think that. But I pretty much think it's just going to be the same. I mean, there's like, of all of the floated VP choices, there's a tons of Zionists in there, and some of them really bad. And so, yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if we're going to get a change at all. I mean, I was thinking, like, I don't know, you know, it can't be any worse than Biden. And that's true, I think. Like, even Trump, I don't, like, if you're just giving them everything all the time. I mean, fucking Netanyahu was just here. So how's Trump going to be fucking worse than that?
Yeah.
But, like, I was like, oh, okay, maybe we have an open, maybe I just felt like it was an opportunity, but I don't think she's going to, I think she'll just pick, like, Josh Shapiro, we're going to be in the same fucking shit.
That'll be a real bad mess.
Yeah, I think she's going to pick Josh Shapiro.
Really?
I think so.
Yeah, because he called the student protesters like the Klan or something, right?
Yeah. With her reaction to what happened in D.C., like, after Biden stepped down, of course, like any probably Delawarean, but most people are like, yes, thank you. Please, you should have did this 6 months ago.
Yeah, I don't even care about this presidential race, but Jesus, stop embarrassing us.
But then, and I was like, okay, maybe she can pivot. I was riding that hopeful wave. But then instantly, like, please just say something slightly pro-Palestinian, and she just...
Or just pro-American, right? Just pro, don't slander Americans exercising their First Amendment rights.
Yes, yes. It was so disheartening, and I was like, okay, I personally cannot vote for her because she's been so complicit up until this point, and then she just completely... kept the same attitude, even though, like, especially for the young vote, that's like a huge thing. Like, I know there's the whole geopolitical thing, and you have, you know, foreign policy in America is like bipartisan, whatnot. But
the blob,
yeah,
the foreign policy blob.
Like, if she was just even gave like the slightest crumb of like, yeah, let's not murder Palestinians. It would do so well for her.
Yeah, I think she did say like one thing that I don't think Biden's ever said or like the Biden White House has ever said, and just that she has seen like all of the pictures of Gaza and they're terrible and all of that stuff. And like, but that was like, it was almost like a caveat. I was she sucks.
Or like her staffers have done those like strategic leaks where she says something that's like, oh, we need a ceasefire now, but it's like just a strategic leak.
And then she's like, oh, but for 6 months.
Yeah.
I mean, again, that's the fun thing to talk about because it's the thing that's happening now. But frankly, I don't have on this issue or really any foreign policy issue, I don't have any. You know, there's a consensus, pretty much. There's a neocon consensus. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's that. I mean, even Biden's sort of like, you know, he's nasty with China.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's no way out of it. Like, the empire is going to have to just do what it does. And I don't, you know, until such time as we can exert more power onto it, I think thinking that somebody might... the other thing is, I do think that politicians do sort of bend with the wind to some extent, but there's only so much play. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, maybe there'll be some bending still. Obviously, if she picks Shapiro, we're fucking dead in the water. Andy Beshear, I don't think is very good either.
Yeah.
I don't know what this guy, the guy from Minnesota. I just like him because he's an old white guy and he's bald. the guy, the Minnesota governor, Tim Walz or something. Yeah. Is that what his name is?
I think so.
Yeah, he seems like a okay fella. But again, mm-hmm. do I expect anything out of any of them? No, mm-hmm. I don't really care.
That's all we kind of expect, though, right? Is that you just aren't on our radar for being an awful human being.
Yeah.
Like, that's all you need.
It's hard at this point.
Yeah, because everything, again, the difficulty is that this is tied into so much nefarious shit. You know, if, you know, who actually gets paid for the weapons that go out of Dover Air Force Base? Well, we pay for them. But who gets that money? Well, why don't you check, you know, Raytheon stock price or mm-hmm. McDonnell Douglas or whatever. Like, yeah, I mean, there's much money to be made. And that needs to kind of continue. So what do we do? Well, you know, yes, there are, you know, babies with their heads blown off on the internet. But what do we do? You know, it's like I feel it's like Kafkaesque almost.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, can we just stop? You know, we don't have to do this. But I don't think anybody really has the, you know, our political system, such as it is, doesn't reward people for the guts to do anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's important for more and more and more people to start applying the pressure.
Yeah.
You know, that's really what it is, because that has been proven to work.
Well, and that's where I was writing that hope that you were talking about earlier. You know, like I was probably as hopeful, if not more hopeful than you. And I saw the exact same statement she put out about the protest. And after witnessing what the protest was and realizing she was, you know, going to completely gaslight the American public to what was going down, I lost all faith in her and I pulled my vote the same way you did. A potential vote, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there was another part of my happiness or my hope there that's still alive, and it's even if, you know, the dissent and honestly the hate and the like, what would you describe like that got you out of bed that morning? Like, what's that feeling?
What morning, sorry?
Like, Wednesday morning. Like, you said you left really early to go scope out that bus. So.
It's just, like, every morning, like, I wake up, I scroll Twitter, I scroll Facebook, and I see dead children.
Yeah.
Like.
So, that empathy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
That could have been me. That could have been, like, my child. Like, just because I was lucky enough to be born in the United States, like. That doesn't change anything. That could have been me.
And I think that collective empathy that's growing, even if that empathy was 10% of what pushed Biden out, right? Because at the end of the day, he got pushed out because he was going to lose. Like, the polls are showing he mm-hmm. was going to lose to Trump, so he got pushed out. Well, he couldn't campaign on college campuses because he would get run out by protesters.
Mm-hmm.
So regardless if we can, you know, get the change that we're looking for with Harris, at the bare minimum, we've shown ourselves and we've shown the establishment, we might not be able to bend you, the politician, but we can play a role, even if it's a small role, in your ousting. And I think that's invigorating. I don't know about for you, but it was for me.
Right? Yeah.
The last 9 months weren't for nothing. The, mm-hmm. you know, Kibbutz Biden was mm-hmm. not for nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's an excellent point, because a lot of work was put in, you know, right down the road here, you know, to wrap up the rank, you know, turn the pressure up, ratchet up the pressure. And, yeah, I mean, you cannot, you know, the fact of the matter is that Team Biden was pressured to drop out. Now, did, you know, groups of screaming people at the front of his neighborhood add to that? Well, it certainly didn't lessen it.
Yeah.
You know, so like you said, how much, who knows? But it certainly, you know, you're going home at night and you just see people tell them how much they hate you
mm-hmm.
for a good reason. Yeah, it can't help. I mean, that was the LBJ thing when LBJ dropped out, right? There was people outside the White House saying, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same sort of, very similar sort of situations. Of course, Humphrey lost, but there's reasons for that. We're not going to get into a big Carl. That's for Carl to do. Carl can figure out what was wrong with the Humphrey campaign.
Yeah.
I'm sure he has a lot of ideas.
Yeah, I don't know if we actually, like, made a difference in Biden's head, but we definitely annoyed some of his staffers, reminded his staffers that every time he came to Delaware, because it wasn't just up in Wilmington area, it was down whenever he was in Rehoboth, too. Yeah. We made it known that, you know, you're not going to forget about this.
And let's be clear, I've mentioned this, too, because I've actually done a few local actions with some of the same Delawareans for Palestinian Liberation groups. And the police have been out in force locally. You know, we had a woman be arrested outside of Carper's house. Mm-hmm. We had another woman be arrested, bird dog in Kearney here. We had one of the same and another woman arrested in the state house on the last day of the legislative session, trying to get the ceasefire resolution passed the state Senate, which it did not. And so, yeah, I think all of that, while it's not fun to have the hand of the police, you know, crack down on dissent, this is going to happen. And it's a step in the process because people are pissed. And they're going to have to remain pissed because it's starting to sort of break into the, break into the news, break into the zeitgeist. Our friend at Legacy Media and at Delaware Online covered Colleen's arrest and, mm-hmm. and subsequent trial. And all of this stuff is starting to get more just awareness. Awareness is building.
Yeah.
And I would love to see, you know, more people get out and protest. I'd love even just more people to get the information from Delfer and like people like Mike Abel. But yeah, I won't call it hopeful, but I'm glad because the process wasn't going to start until people started to get motivated and people started being exposed to like just the history.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, well, why? This is weird. Because people tell you, I mean, you probably heard this and it was one of the things you should drive me crazy. Well, it's really complicated. It's mm-hmm. very complicated. I can't really say anything because I'm not there. You know, I don't know that. It's, you know, I don't know. Yeah. They've been fighting for thousands of years. Well, of course, none of that's true. Mm-hmm. That's all fake. You know, they're just doing a European colonial project somewhere. It's happened all over. It's been bad all over. So we know what we're dealing with, and nothing's going to change until there's a groundswell of people who are willing to go put their bodies on the line and really speak out about it. So I'm fucking stoked you guys came in here.
Yeah.
Very happy.
Yeah, just real quick to talk about that is that, like, the ease of information on the internet. Like, I read about, you know, the civil rights protests or even, like, the AIDS epidemic protests that happened. Like, the ease of information to explain what's happening, especially if it's over in the Middle East. Like, I can just watch some kid in Gaza's TikTok videos and see how he's living. I don't have to interpret it. It's just there. And then using all of the information that I've gathered on the internet to be able to organize, it's kind of crazy. So as horrible as the internet is, it does make me hopeful because of the ease of information.
Yeah, if, as you said, during the civil rights era, very famously, you know, there was a huge groundswell when people started seeing it on the Walter Cronkite news, mm-hmm. you know, the fire hoses and dogs being sicked on people.
Yep.
You know, students were going down to do freedom rides and try to register people to vote, and some of them were getting killed or beat up. But, like, you know, the media isn't what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you know, they started seeing the real crackdown and the cops really crack heads, there was an awareness was raised. Obviously, it didn't do something overnight, but it was very significant. It's historically significant. And I think we'll find the same thing with this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, having it put right in front of you and having to reckon with it is powerful.
Yep.
Last word? You?
Free Palestine.
Yeah. Free Palestine. I was going to say the same thing.
Philistine Hura.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing we say here is left is best.
Left is best.
Left is best.